Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, almost 20% of heterosexual married men cheat, and 15% of women do too. Straying is even more common in a committed dating relationship. More than half of that group cheats. So what drives people to seek love and sex elsewhere? Is it biology, psychology, or both? Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg has treated people for compulsive sexual behavior for 2 decades. In his new book, he explores the why of infidelity and looks at how men and women are differently motivated to cheat. He also dives into how relationships work after an unfaithful partner is exposed and the best way forward for couples who decide to make a go of it in the wake of an affair. Our conversation starts after a short break. Whether you're married or just dating, a significant number of us cheat. It might be a one-time encounter or a long-term affair. It might be a secret and deeply emotional friendship or a series of sexual trysts. So what drives people inside a committed relationship to seek a different relationship outside of the first one? Is it lust, boredom, genetics? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg delves into brain chemistry and desire, the science behind cheating, and he explores the rules of recovery if a couple decides to stay together and press past an affair. It's all in his book, Infidelity, Why Men and Women Cheat, and he joins us now from the Radio Foundation in New York City. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be here.
So you've identified 3 determinants of cheating: brain, psychology, and culture. Can you break those down?
Sure. I mean, I think they are interactive. One affects the other. But certainly, you know, we are determined in part by our biology. Freud said many years ago, a century ago, that anatomy is destiny, that, you know, what is in our brains, what is in our bodies really determines quite a bit. But Freud was also a champion of psychological thinking as well, and certainly how we think, what's not only in our brains, but what's in our minds, has a huge impact on us. And that's all in constant and, I would say, dynamic flux with what's in our environment. So some people have more dopamine reactivity or more testosterone. Some people have more of a narcissistic personality. And some people are just spend all their time looking at porn. And you can imagine what's in the culture, what's in your mind, what's in your brain, again, is in a kind of dynamic flux and constantly affects us.
So how much of that motivation to cheat is actually biological? Can it be mostly blamed on brain chemistry, or is it more likely to be a combination of all of it?
Well, I don't think, you know, it's not a question of blame, right? Because, you know, you can't, if you're caught cheating, you can't say to your spouse, your betrayed spouse, you can't say, you know, pardon me, my brain made me do it, or my biology made me do it. So there's no blame or excuse. But I think that, you know, we're a result of many, many factors, our brain being a very important part of it. And we have an evolutionary heritage. Millions of years of evolution have kind of collaborated or conspired, if you will, to get us to the point where we have brains that want to socially bond, want us to connect to other people, but we also want to procreate. We also want to lust after other people and lust often after new people. Novelty is a turn-on. That's a biological phenomena.
So this was interesting to me. You said infidelity has less to do with sex and more with deception. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that what I say is infidelity has, you know, affairs are not made in the bedroom. They're made in your mind. And, you know, a lot of what we're thinking about and how we fantasize about an affair has a lot to do with whether we have an affair or whether we think about it. Also, infidelity doesn't have to do with, you know, being with other lovers. I mean, some people decide you could be with 10 lovers, you know, but they want 11 or they want 12. So infidelity is cheating. It's breaking the rules. So I think there's 2 things in the book that we talk about. One is, you know, the scope of infidelity. The other is that infidelity really has to do with lying to your partner. Not with having sex with other people, but about lying about it.
So what motivates men and women differently to cheat? Are different genders seeking different things in an affair?
Well, I think traditionally speaking, they do. Traditionally speaking, men are seeking more of a physical connection, you know, traditionally, and women are seeking more of an emotional connection. Now, I think that's true for older Americans, but when you look at younger Americans, they're just kind of looking for the same thing, whatever it is. And they're looking for both an emotional connection and or a physical connection. And certainly an emotional connection and a physical connection are the most alluring, are the things that really captivate our minds and our brains the most.
And that's something you made it, you were asked, I guess, at the time to have some commentary on the HBO series Sex and the City. And at the time you thought that the portrayal of how women had sex in that show was not exactly dead on with how women tend to approach sex. But you say right. In hindsight, the show kind of seemed to forecast the future a bit.
I think so. I mean, I think that if you look at Girls and, you know, other shows, other things in contemporary culture, you know, you really see the evidence of that women have more sexual agency as they did in Sex and the City. And I think that, you know, I know that was true for a small number of women, but in the 1990s when that show came out. But now it's, you know, very true that women, in my mind, fortunately have economic freedom, more economic freedom, not as much as we would like or as I would like. Women fortunately have more sexual agency. Women feel more free to do what men do, for better or for worse. And I think that, I think Sex and the City was really ahead of its time, or maybe it was just part of the cultural zeitgeist that changed the time.
So one thing you note is that the percentage of heterosexual married men who cheat has stayed pretty steady in recent past, but the percentage of women who cheat has gone kind of on the uptick. Do you think that's just a reflection of what you were just talking about, the fact that kind of the female culture of sex has changed, or is something else going on there?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, all we could say for sure is that while over the past 20 years, the number of men cheating has remained the same, the number of women cheating over the past 20 years has doubled, gone from 10% to 15%. And yes, I believe it's probably because women have more greater sexual agency, what I would call sexual agency, and they have more economic freedom. You know, when it comes to divorce, nowadays, at least 70% of divorces are initiated by the women. That has nothing to do with cheating, but it has to do with the fact that women don't feel trapped as much anymore, and they feel, if this is a bad relationship, I could leave. And I think that's a relatively new phenomenon.
And another interesting little statistic was that women who make more money and have more education are more likely to cheat. Well, can you explain that a bit?
Well, yes. I mean, educated women are more likely to cheat. Women who make more money, particularly more money than their spouses, are likely to cheat. And I think it has to do with, probably has to do with sexual empowerment and just feeling, you know, you have options in life. You have choices in life. Again, I'm not a sociologist. I don't know if there's any sociological answer. It's just the data that we have.
So something that I wanted to ask about, can you explain some of the differences between cheating within heterosexual relationships and cheating within homosexual relationships? Is there a difference in how partners perceive an affair?
Well, I don't think that. I think that, you know, now that gay and lesbian folks are married, I think that there's probably relatively little difference. And I think that within, you know, certain cultures or subcultures, there might be more tolerance of having, you know, other lovers kind of join the relationship. But I think at the end of the day, whether you're gay or straight, you really feel that, you know, a relationship that competes with your relationship, a relationship in which you prefer to be with someone else than your partner, is a real threat. So I think that there's more similarities and differences. Traditionally speaking, gay and lesbian couples, and gay men in particular, have been more open to having a third partner join them, to having a threesome, to having, to being able to venture outside the relationship within the boundaries of safety. So they've been more open to non-monogamy, traditionally speaking. But I think that at the end of the day, as I say, whether you're gay or straight or whatever your sexual orientation, you really want to know that what you hear from your partner is the truth. You really want to know that your partner being there for you is something you can count on. I don't think it matters what your sexual orientation is.
Can certain things trigger infidelity? I know in the book you mentioned that sometimes when a man loses a parent, that can kind of be a jumping off point for an affair, which I had never even thought about that or heard about that before. First of all, why would that maybe trigger something? But also, are there other things that can kind of push people to take that step towards cheating?
Yeah, you know, there's many things, but it is something I've observed in my practice. We have a group for men who have sex addiction, who are compulsively philandering, compulsively cheating. And in our group, when we talk about it, we often find that is a familial loss that prompts it. And again, you know, we could create a theory about it. We could say that, you know, the loss of a parent makes you feel that life is short, or the loss of a parent stresses you out and you look for, or the loss of a sibling stresses you out and you look for other ways to, you know, be satisfied. But it's an interesting phenomenon. I think there are many stresses, you know, that create challenges to couples. Anything from a loss to someone who really becomes obsessed with pornography, or who begins a new relationship, what I would call an emotional affair with someone, or they just kind of get bored, which married people do. I mean, you know, marriage and relationships, as I think we all know, take work. You know, it's easy to fall in love. It's not so easy to stay in love and to continue that love in a dedicated fashion for decades. And I think that, you know, most people aren't really ready for that. They say they are, but they're not really ready to really do the hard work of a relationship. And I think that probably is the greatest threat to a marriage, that kind of, you know, failure to work hard at something which is not so easy and which in our contemporary culture, there's lots of challenges too. You know, we're constantly bombarded with information about sexiness and affairs, and you know, you can read the front page without seeing an affair or an allegation of some sort, and you know, that's really in our world. So there's lots of challenges to relationships nowadays. I think there always were, but you know, painfully aware as a psychiatrist that there are challenges now. And I think people need to be ready for that, you know? They need to have a discussion at some point early on, what do we do when we lust after someone else? What do we do when, you know, the sex is kind of boring? How do we deal with that? What do we do when what we want is forbidden? And, you know, you could play act with me, you know, you could say to your partner, play act like, you know, we've just met, but you can't really recreate that kind of new relationship energy, you know, that thing that you get your butterflies in your stomach. You can't make pretend that it's a new relationship when you've been married for decades. So, you know, I think that we need to address it. I think that's the biggest threat. You know, our expectations that we're going to be happy forever and our failure to take responsibility for our happiness and for our relationships.
What do you mean when you say we tend to pair up with people from our own tribe but desire people from another?
We like novelty. We also like what we don't have. But biologically, novelty is good. Novelty is really good for our, you know, our species. When we, you know, if we're attracted to someone who's from another tribe, that means our progeny, our children, are likely to be healthier. It's a great experiment called the sweaty T-shirt experiment, right? You've read about that in my book, in which people smell T-shirts from people who they might opposite gender people if they're heterosexual inclined. And when they smell these T-shirts, sounds like a disgusting idea, I know. But when they smell these T-shirts, right, they are then asked to say which of these sweaty T-shirts they're more attracted to. And who you think they're more attracted to?
People that are different.
People who have what's called a histocompatibility immune complex, you know, a genetic complex which has to do with our immune system, who are different. And that makes sense because we need to have our babies immune to as many diseases as possible. So, that we're attracted to, but yet we marry someone down the block. And our parents say, you got to marry someone, you know, who's like you, and whatever reason, race, religion, you know, has the same values, grew up in the same neighborhood. And a bit of a challenge there, I think.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg. His book is called Infidelity: Why Men and Women Cheat. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERAThink. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg. His book is called Infidelity: Why Men and Women Cheat. Dr. Rosenberg, can you tell us about the Coolidge effect?
Oh, Coolidge effect is really interesting. So President Coolidge is touring a farm. And first his wife, I think her name was Grace, if I recall correctly, is touring the farm. And she comes to the hen house, and she is told that the rooster is constantly having sex, and the hens are constantly having sex. And perhaps Mrs. Coolidge wasn't, may I say, getting in enough at home. And she says to the farmer, when the president comes around, you tell him exactly what you told me, that rooster is having sex all the time. Okay. So the president comes around and is told this and, you know, told that the roosters and the hens are having sex all the time. And the president wisely asked the farmer, same hen every time? And the farmer says, no, different hen every time. And the president says, tell that to Mrs. Coolidge. So, you know, the idea, there's another experiment which we'll talk about. You drop a rat in a cage, drop a new rat in the cage, you take... let's backtrack. You have two rats that are copulating to exhaustion. They're completely done with whatever they're doing. They can't have any more sex. But then you drop a new rat in the cage. And what do you think happens?
Second wind,
right. It's like the rats are like, where have you been my whole life, you know? All of a sudden, they're very attracted to each other. So what's the point? We like a new rat in the cage. And whatever that means for us. And, you know, that's temptation. You know, as we say, the grass is always greener. And there's good reason for that. That's probably a biological imperative, an evolutionary imperative. That's the Coolidge effect.
So you alluded to this in the first segment, but, you know, cheating is everywhere. You read about it in the newspaper. There's magazine features devoted to it. And it's the central theme to so many different novels, television shows, and movies.
What happened? It's gotta be something big. You were crazy about him 2 days ago.
He's got a wife, okay? He's married.
And you don't think you can take her?
That's not the point. I don't do married guys. I don't need to wreck someone's home for a date.
It's not always a wreck. Stan and I were married when we met. We weren't happy.
You wrecked two marriages.
First of all, one of them was mine, so that doesn't count.
I don't think that's how it works.
All I'm saying is that I think married guys would be the perfect fit for you. I think you need someone with something that's gonna keep him busy.
Not a wife!
Somebody's being negative. I'm gonna go. But I'll tell you what my mother told me, and these are words to live by. Selfish people live longer.
That was a clip from the 2014 movie, The Other Woman, and it was a conversation between Nicki Minaj and Cameron Diaz. So why do you think, if cheating is as prevalent as it seems based on real-life stories and news stories, why are we so fixated on it in pop culture and media?
Because it's a threat to our relationship. Because we know, whether we say it or not, that we're struggling with two evolutionary mandates. One is the desire to connect, the desire to socially bond, I would say. The desire for two people, or however many people, to remain together long enough to rear an offspring. That's what evolution requires. We also know intuitively, whether we say it or not, we know intuitively that we have the desire to lust after others. And those are at odds with each other. So this is, you know, a common struggle. This is a struggle of love and lust. And I think it occupies us on a daily basis and, of course, permeates our culture and permeates our literature.
Let's take a call now from Kimber in Cleburne. Kimber, go ahead with your question.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I had two questions. One was very similar to the one that you just asked about the pop culture. I was asking, you know, why do you think that it is that the ideas that are portrayed in...
Kimber, are you still there? Okay, I think we lost her. I think what she was getting at was, do things like movies and television, does that factor into our perception of cheating? Does it change it? Does it make it easier for us to justify? Or does it, because it's pervasive, does it seem like it's more normal than it is?
Well, I think so. I think there's truth in that. That I think that, you know, as I said, you know, it's not clear if Sex and the City was a forerunner of change or that Sex and the City changed us. And by Sex and the City, I mean a lot of, you know, what's out there in culture. I think they were very influenced by culture and what we read and what we see. And we're certainly very influenced by the internet. You know, we talk a lot about that in the book, and I'm happy to get into it. But, you know, the long and short of it is that cheating is now quite easy because of the internet.
And that was, you read my mind, that was where I was going next. So how has the internet changed both, you know, relationships and infidelity and potential for infidelity?
You swipe right or you swipe left, you know. It's there was an article, and I think it was in the Daily Mail or the Telegraph, you know, one of the London papers about my book. And they spoke to a woman who said, you know, it's easier to cheat now than order a pizza. I don't know if that's quite true, but it's... I guess it depends on where you live, but, you know, it's pretty easy to cheat. And, there are websites dedicated to this. It's very easy to meet people online. It's very easy to have hookups. You know, we're you know, part of a culture that grew up with hookups, and we're part of a culture now that it has very, very easy access to, you know, the internet. And forget about hooking up. We have easy access to pornography. A lot of people spend a lot of time on pornography. It's a very, very common, you know, preoccupation for a lot of people. And that doesn't help with marital or spousal or relationship satisfaction.
And how does pornography fit into all this? You know, does it count as cheating? Does it become a relationship of its own at some point?
Well, I think it depends on what the couple feels. I mean, there are some couples who feel that, you know, any pornography constitutes cheating. There's some couples who can't wait to look at porn together, and the last thing they would call it is cheating. So I think it really depends. You know, from where I sit as a psychiatrist who treats people with porn addiction, is that sometimes porn rises to the threshold of being a real problem. And what does that mean? That means instead of being with your spouse, you're with your phone. That means during the day, instead of, you know, working, you spend literally hours with the door of your office shut if you have an office, or the door of your car is locked, really looking, obsessing over porn. You know, when the first phones came out, they were called crackberries because phones are like crack. And, you know, they're what we call dopamine multipliers. They multiply that kind of reward system that we need and rely on called dopamine.
And that's regardless of what you're looking at, right? I mean,
a phone regardless, it's if you're on Facebook, right? So add sex to that. Add the biggest igniter of the reward system, the biggest igniter of the reward system. Add that to the mix. You have quite a potent dopamine multiplier, in my view.
Has technology also become a pretty useful tool at finding cheaters out? I'm guessing there's a lot of digital traces and trails.
Yeah.
And talk about that a bit.
Well, you know, we have this little phone and we think it's anonymous, and it's really a, you know, lifelong record of our unconscious, of our thoughts, of what we look for, of what we search for, of what we're thinking, of what we're curious about. What we dare not tell anyone, but we pursue when we have the privacy of our phone. And unfortunately, the phone's not all that private, as we're seeing. And even if you're a very good criminal, a very good cover-upper, you know, you delete everything, it's kind of hard to stay on top of that. There's always an email account, or there's always a this or that, you know, that someone could find. And spouses do that. And for most of my patients, the way they're discovered cheating is through their phones.
And we'll get a little bit more into kind of recovering if an affair has discovered a little bit later in the show. But I'm assuming that, you know, if someone finds text message evidence or email evidence of a partner's affair and it forwards them to themselves or screenshots them, people can probably really drive themselves crazy kind of reviewing all of this evidence over and over again.
Oh, my God. Oh, you're sort of talking about betrayed partners.
Right, right. The person who's
discovered. Oh, my God.
Discovered.
It's so horrible. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But, you know, it's something we call pain, P-A-I-N, shopping. You know, you should know if your partner's cheating. You have every right to understand what happened. But the relentless review of this kind of material is really terrible, and it really hurts us quite a bit.
Can you tell me what a virtual affair is?
Well, it's sort of what we talked about. I mean, porn could be a virtual affair. Sexting could be a virtual affair. So you meet someone in a chat room, and you have a sidebar, and you develop a relationship with them. More often than not, you'll meet that person if these chats continue. But the idea of just of not meeting someone but having phone sex or having virtual sex or, you know, if I'm masturbating to, you know, with your affair partner to this, that's what I would call a virtual affair. But porn, you know, the relentless obsession with porn, I would say that could also be a virtual affair.
So some of these virtual affairs, from my understanding, they play out for a very long time. I mean, people have relationships that begin as just messages back and forth, and they really feel like they're connected in a way that maybe even supersedes their marriage or relationship.
Right. The phone affords us great intimacy. You know, mm-hmm. it's like being on a plane and you talk to the person next to you. You know, it's a stranger, but now all of a sudden you feel the comfort of revealing everything. And the phone also encourages you to say things impulsively and quickly that you would never say. I mean, how many times have all of us sent an email and we're like, oh, geez, I really should not have sent that email. Well, that happens in a sexual context. And these kinds of, you know, impulsive, lustful things really happen often on the phone.
My question is, if a virtual affair begins online and stays there for a long time, but creates, you know, deep feelings of intimacy and maybe someone leaves their partner for the person they began the virtual affair with, does that ever come crashing down when the virtual part is removed and now it's two people actually trying to have a relationship?
Well, of course, the answer is yes. I mean, I think probably it comes crashing down more often than not because, you know, we say in the book that affairs are made in the mind, not in the bedroom. And of course, virtual affairs where you're texting and projecting and, you know, attributing all these things to this person who you don't even often know what they look like. And, you know, you see a picture and it may not even be the real picture. You know, it's very, very hard for reality to match up to that fantasy.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Let's spend a little bit of time on the concept of the emotional affair. I've certainly heard a lot of people throw that term around just in my everyday life. How would you kind of distinguish between a friendship or camaraderie at the office and an emotional affair? What's the difference?
Well, I think there is a simple way to differentiate. You know, friends you bring into your fold. You say to your husband or your wife, hey, I met this great person in the office. You should meet them and we should all go together. We should meet their partner and, you know, get to know them. And we all have dear friends and we all have incredibly passionate pastimes. Some of us, it's, you know, golf or baseball, you know, but there are a lot of things that we're passionate about. An emotional affair is different. An emotional affair is competition. It's not just, you know, you're friendly with someone, but you're yearning to be with that person. Sex may not be on the table, but sex is often under the table. There's a sense when you're with this person, if only I could be with them, you know, if only we could have sex. We're such so perfect. Often when you're with this person, you know, your emotional affair partner, that is, you're saying bad things about your partner. Mm-hmm. You're saying, you know, my spouse just, I don't know, she or he just doesn't understand me the way you do. And so in a sense, you're creating competition. You're undermining your relationship. You're taking your emotional energy and, you know, feeling that I can't wait to speak to my emotional affair partner. I can't wait till my spouse goes to sleep so I could get on Facebook and, you know, talk to them. And that's not good for a marriage. That's not good for a relationship, right?
So here's a question we got via email that ties in pretty closely with what we're talking about. Jared in Plano sent us a note and said, what are some factors that may cause some people to feel that either physical cheating or emotional cheating is more hurtful? Is that gendered, or is it just depend on who you are or the circumstances?
That's a great question. Thanks for the question, Jared. One of the things that we find is that when you ask men and women, which is worse, a physical affair or an emotional affair, what do you think the men say?
I'm guessing physical.
Physical, right. And what do you think the women say?
Right. Other side of the
emotional.
Coin.
And it's probably, I hate to say this, I'll probably get a lot of mail for this, but I think women understand things a whole lot better. Emotional affairs are very, very damaging to a relationship. They really are. They could really hurt the relationship. And of course, the most potent combination is both emotional and physical.
My question is, do emotional affairs that start out as maybe two people meeting for lunch or talking online, and do they often intensify into a sexual affair? I mean, does that happen regularly?
Often. Yes. I mean, the data is that 80%, I don't know. You know, it's hard to study these things. It's not like there's, you know, great studies with controlled placebo groups done by, you know, major universities. But to the best of our understanding, the majority of those do progress. Because if you're constantly, you know, in this emotional, deep emotional connection or a virtual connection, eventually you're really longing to be with the person. And as you said earlier, often that blows up because, you know, the physical relationship really can't meet your expectations of what you thought would be.
Of all the types of, I mean, I know there's a lot of different ways you can cheat on your partner. It could be a one-time encounter, or you could have many, many different sexual partners outside of your marriage over a long period of time, or a long-term emotional affair. Which is the hardest for a couple to recover from? Like, is there a specific circumstance that just is very tough for two people that are committed to say, we can get past it?
Well, I think that really depends on the couple. You know, it depends on the rules of the game, depends on the rules they establish, depends on their expectations. You know, some guys say, you know, if my wife has an emotional affair, no problem, but if she has a physical affair, I can't tolerate that. So it really depends a lot on where the person is coming from. But I would say, as I've said, sorry to repeat myself, it's a combination of an emotional affair and a physical affair. And if the person stays in your life, that's most challenging for a couple.
My guest this hour is Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, who wrote Infidelity, Why Men and Women Cheat. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a few minutes. That was an excerpt from the song Before He Cheats by Carrie Underwood. You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking to Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg about his book Infidelity, Why Men and Women Cheat. So as the song we just heard suggests, a lot of people focus on revenge once an affair is revealed. Why do so many people have that instinct to, you know, beat up their cheating partner's car?
Well, what a great song from Carrie Underwood. Thanks for playing a little bit of that.
Sure thing.
It's great. You know, when we're betrayed, it's just about the worst feeling we can experience often. Some of my patients who are betrayed have experienced death of parents, of siblings. They've experienced losses of all kind. But betrayal really strikes as something very deep in our souls, I would say. You know, we find someone, we feel we could depend on them. We build a life around them. We fight with them, we yell at them, but we don't really think that they would ever betray us, not to mention leave us. And when that happens, it gets us really, I mean, I think it really strikes to the core of our DNA, quite literally. And betrayal trauma is just sometimes the worst trauma we can experience. People get very depressed, they lose weight. It's sort of like a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and very, very hard to deal with. So what happens when we get hurt? We want revenge. We want someone to pay.
So can seeking revenge or chairing a smear campaign against a cheating partner, can that be cathartic, or does that do more harm than good to you?
Well, I mean, you know, my position from reading my book, I think that it's not a wise approach. I could understand why people would want to do it. It makes perfect sense to me. But to have a negative publicity campaign against your cheating partner, to let your friends and neighbors and his or her parents and even let the children know about it, I don't think that's wise, honestly. I understand why people want to do it. But yes, I think it does more harm than good. In fact, I think it does a great deal of harm. You know, once you release this kind of information in the community, you can't control it. And once you say things to your children, you can't take them back. You can't say, you know, I didn't really kind of mean that. I was just angry. So, yeah, I think that my advice, very simply, when you discover your spouse is cheating is, you know, you need to stand up for yourself. You need to do something about it. But definitely think before you speak, particularly to others.
Let's take a call now from Sadie in Carrollton. Sadie, go ahead.
Hi. So my question was about flirting. You were earlier talking about emotional affairs, and you know, my question is how dangerous is flirting? Is it a way to sort of, I guess sometimes people see it as harmless or as something that can reaffirm their self-confidence, or is it really something that is, you know, borderline a betrayal, like you were talking about?
Good question. What do you think?
Very good question, Sadie. You know, I wouldn't want to legislate flirting or say what people can or cannot do. But I would say, you know, there are better ways to seek validation and affirmation than flirting, honestly. You know, flirting is essentially seen as a precursor to a romantic or sexual relationship. And I'm not sure it's really, you know, best to put your energy out there if you're in a committed relationship and you want to keep that relationship. And if you're seeking affirmation or validation, which is a very important reason why people cheat, I don't think that's a good reason to cheat. And so I would say, you know, I don't want to legislate flirting. I don't want to say what you could or could not do. But I would say that I would discourage you from flirting if you're doing it to make yourself feel better, because that's not going to make you feel better at the end of the game. And you know, if there's an issue with your self-esteem or your sexual, you know, feelings about yourself, you think you're not worthwhile, there's probably better ways to deal with it than to, you know, do something that might be competitive to your relationship.
Let's take one more call from Ken in Plano. Ken, go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi. I'm really curious to know what you think. How has the Me Too movement and men and women holding men accountable for sexual harassment changed this conversation? And I'm really curious how it breaks down generationally.
Mm. Well, that's a great question, Ken. I mean, I think I am very supportive of the Me Too movement because I think that finally, you know, it's, well, what can I say? It's the tip of the iceberg of this matter. You know, women are exploited in all kinds of ways, socially, economically, and indeed sexually. So I think that it's elevated the conversation. I think it's made people aware of this. It's made people aware that, you know, cheating is not a legit thing to do. It's not a cool thing to do. And certainly taking advantage of someone, which goes beyond cheating. I mean, in some ways, that could even be a sexual offense, if not a sexual crime. That's a discussion that I think our country really needs to have. How's it break down generationally? I'm not sure what you mean by that, Ken. I think you're probably asking, do, you know, for an older generation that has become accustomed to this kind of terrible misbehavior, I think it's actually making them rethink it. And for a younger generation, it's making them realize that this just is not okay.
I was shocked to find that 90% of partners never find out about cheating. The movies have misled me, I guess. I assumed it was an inevitability, but for the most part, it just goes undetected?
Yes, for the most part, people get away with it. But if you, you know, in my experience with my patients, if you cheat over and over again, no matter how good a criminal you might be, you get found out. But yes, 90% of the time, your spouse doesn't know it. And for those 10%, as we said, it can be really devastating.
And you say some people actually kind of leave a little trail of breadcrumbs so they do get caught by a spouse or partner.
Yes. You know, I often see my patients cheating as an act not just of indulgence, but as an act of self-destruction, as an act of self-hatred. I think that people often cheat in a way that almost makes clear, makes certain that they will get caught. And they know they're, speaking about flirting, they're flirting with disaster.
How do cheating spouses gaslight their partners?
They say, you know, how could you? Gaslighting is what that movie was, 1942 or something.
Right.
You know, an old movie in which, someone's making pretend that they're or trying to convince their partner that they're losing their mind when they're not. Well, gaslighting is if you're a cheating spouse and you're discovered, you say, how could you say that? I would never cheat on you. And then when they find evidence, your betrayed partner finds evidence, you say, you know, you're absolutely wrong. This is a figment of your imagination. And that is, you know, what people often do. Or they say, you know, how could you say I slept with, you know, Susie, or I was interested in Debbie? I was never interested in them. Well, maybe you were never interested in Susie or Debbie, but you did a whole lot with a whole lot of other people that your, you know, spouse has no idea about. So gaslighting is really, instead of saying, you know, I've been a jerk, I've made a mistake, and I need to, you know, recover from this, and we need to recover from this, saying, nah, this is all in your head, never happened, get over it.
Another thing you shared with a few when you did talk a little bit about some of the patients you've treated. Of course, you changed names and details to protect them. But I know one of the women who had cheated on her partner immediately backtracked and said, well, I only cheated on him because I knew he'd cheat on me one day and I wanted to beat him to the punch,
Yes, that's right.
I guess he never ended up cheating on her a single time in their entire relationship.
Right.
But what is that mechanism where you have to immediately justify it with something so bizarre it almost can't ring true?
Yeah, I mean, it's a psychological mechanism. We often lie to ourselves. And I think that actually this woman I talked about in my book really did believe that one day her partner would cheat on her, and she was just kind of doing this as a preemptive effort. We do a lot of stupid things in our lives, and we cheat for many reasons. As we've said earlier, cheating is not necessarily about sex. It's about more a psychological construct. It's often, as we spoke about just a few minutes ago, it's about validation, trying to feel better about yourself. Sometimes it's about power. Certainly in the Me Too movement, we see that men are really usurping their power. And it's not so much about sex, but often it's about coercion and power and trying to assert some kind of crazy authority in a very terrible way. So people cheat and have affairs for all kinds of reasons that often have little to do with actual sex.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So if an affair has been revealed, and both people are in on it, what are those first steps in repairing that relationship if both people decide they want to?
Well, you often have to say goodbye to the affair partner because it's very hard to construct or reconstruct a marriage when you have that which threatens the marriage in your midst. So usually you have to break off all ties with the affair partner. Now, sometimes that's impossible because they're your next-door neighbor and you're not going to move, or, you know, they're even related to your spouse. So a lot of repair has to happen. But the first step is just really to gather your thoughts, to think, you know, seriously and constructively. I talk in the book how, you know, people often think the solution for cheating or discovering cheating is to jump into bed, that all we need to do is have more sex and that will take care of everything. Well, that's really not a good solution. In fact, that often backfires. So, you know, thoughtful consideration. And I would say, you know, I'm a therapist. That's what I do for a living. I say talking to someone who does therapy is a good idea, or talking to someone you could trust. You know, talking to your clergy who you trust and know and depend on for guidance is often a good approach. But in general, my first prescription is to, you know, think and relax and work your way into this and not jump into any impulsive action, even, you know, having sex right away, but to really kind of try to work this through.
And I don't remember if you had numbers on this or not, but if both people are committed to repairing the relationship, how often does that actually work when an affair is in the background?
Well, I don't think there are any hard numbers on that from the data, but I could tell you in my experience mm-hmm. that happens more often than not. In fact, if the couple is, or if both members of the couple are really committed to each other, and if both members of the couple are committed to a constructive approach, which, despite Carrie Underwood's brilliant song, means not seeking revenge, but seeking, you know, a healthy reconciliation. Well, if both couples, both members of the couple are in that kind of frame of mind, if you will, in my experience, almost always they work it out.
How can, like, making a gratitude list, for example, eat away at some of the resentments that someone's carrying around tied to infidelity?
Oh, you know, it's a very good idea. I mean, a gratitude list comes from the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and some of those wonderful self-help groups that exist. But the idea is that, you know, what they say in recovery in the addiction movement is that gratitude is the best attitude. And I certainly agree with that. You know, to be grateful for what you have and to realize there are lots of bumps and hiccups and all kinds of obstacles along the road, you know, that we face. But if we could think about, you know, not just put on a happy face, but we could think about what we truly have in our life, you know, a lot of happiness can result from that. In every religious tradition, there's something akin to the Serenity Prayer, which asks God to give us the ability to understand what we could change and to accept what we can't, but to be grateful for what we have. So gratitude is extremely important in recovery of all sorts.
Do some people really move forward with trying to repair the relationship for even a long period of time, but eventually they just cannot get past what they know?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, that happens. But I would say in those situations, it's not that they can't get past what they know, is that the relationship really isn't able to last. Not necessarily because of the affair, sometimes because of the affair, but often because just this couple's on a wrong path and there's nothing they can do to right the ship.
And the deficiency may or may not have been there before or after the affair.
And the, you know, it's when you, the affair is often, you know, 50% of the time people cheat and they're happy in their marriage. But a vast, you know, a lot of time people cheat because they're unhappy in their marriage. You take away the cheating, that doesn't necessarily take care of all the problems.
My guest this hour was Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, who wrote Infidelity, Why Men and Women Cheat. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you so much for your time. What an interesting conversation.
Courtney, a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.